So, good morning to everybody.
Good morning.
This, what is it, November 10th, 2012. Yes. We're going to be looking at the parasha, the section of Genesis 23 to 25.
You're although, recording, right?
I hope so, yes. And I think we won't probably make it much past Genesis 23. We'll see what happens. So let's start off with some prayer. I would pray. Lord, thank you for bringing us here this morning in this nice fall weather. We thank you for all your blessings. And we ask that you would be present and reveal yourself to us through the words that you've written so long ago that still speak today. We want to know you better, and we want your Holy Spirit in our life. Mm-hmm. And just bless this whole service today. In your name. Amen. Okay. So we've been talking about Abraham for a couple weeks now, following the parasha. And we're last week, for those, I believe it was not recorded, right, Gary?
No.
And for those listening to the recording, if you have a problem with that, write into Narkis and tell Gary that he needs to record his Bible studies.
Oh.
So it's unfortunate you didn't hear it. Just to recap, we talked about Abraham and the 10 testings of Abraham. That's one of the interpretations. It's not in our canon that he was tested 10 times, but it is in our canon that he was tested. And the number of testing, as we looked at elsewhere, I think it was a verse from Numbers, when the people of Israel tested God these 10 times. 10 in the Bible tends to represent testing and trial. And so early Jewish interpreters went back over Abraham's life and started trying to find the 10 times when Abraham was tested, showing his complete testing. And you can read some of the literature that was just before Jesus' time circulating in the Jewish world about Abraham's testing. But the reason it pertains to us today is we are doing Genesis 23, Chaye Sarah. This is the life of Sarah. And this is just following the binding of Isaac, when Isaac was nearly sacrificed. Many interpret that as the ultimate test, right? The sacrifice of the promised son. And rightly so. But there was a couple who said, no, a couple of interpreters who said, no, this can't be the final test, because if it were, you would have, you know, and the Lord blessed him. If you glance at chapter 24,
yeah.
It says, and the Lord blessed Abraham in everything. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of like, you know, a summary that you'd expect after all his tests and then the blessing. Genesis 24, verse 1. Abraham was getting old, and God had blessed him in everything. Like this nice summary of his blessing, similar to at the end of Job, you know, you have him blessed after all this trial. Anyway, so they said, if this summary statement of Abraham being blessed comes in chapter 24, it means that his final test was actually chapter 23, which is the chapter we're going to be looking at this morning. And so then they started discussing buying the burial cave and why this is his ultimate test. And so they read through the chapter we're about to read, and we're going to see some of these things. And they determined that it was a test of his patience. And so we can be thinking about that as well, as this being the final test of Abraham, buying this field. Some other interesting points to keep in the back of our mind, if you're thinking about the binding of Isaac being like the climactic text, if we look back in the parasha, chapter 22:19, that's a restatement of the blessing to Abraham. Oh, no, sorry. Wrong verse. earlier, 15.
Okay.
The angel of the Lord calls to Abraham again from heaven. And he says, you know, I've sworn, because you've done this thing and haven't kept your one and only son from me, that I will surely bless you and I will make you multitude. And your seed will be like the stars of heaven and like the sand on the sea, etc. This is also the last time that God speaks to Abraham, in according to the biblical text. So that's another interesting thought to follow, since we discussed last week how Abraham walked before God, in contrast to Noah, who walked with God. And we compared it, Gary was leading, and he compared it to holding a child's hand. You're walking with that person, guiding them. But Abraham, he was supposed to be mature, and he was like a teenager, where you can send him out in front of you and say, hey, you know, turn right or left, because they're more mature. So to walk before God meant to walk in front of him, so to speak. And if you're thinking about Abraham's life as presented in the Bible, you know, this is the last direct revelation. So chapter 23, 24, 25, it's kind of like his character has developed to such where he's expected to go on without divine revelation. Which is where many of us can identify, maybe, who have not received direct audible voices from heaven. Where you have to trust God's working and also what he's implanted in you to make decisions. Now, Abraham is a great character as well. Weeks ago we talked about him being the father of faith, meaning the father of faithfulness. Then we looked last week at him being enduring through all these trials, how that's part of his faith, to be faithful through these trials. And also between the lines, you can find where maybe Abraham lacked certain things and did not have strong faith. However, ultimately, the fact that, you know, he continues following the Lord is still faith, even if he has bouts of lack of faith. What can you remember in Abraham's life that would be a lack of faith? When he goes to Egypt. Why in the world did he go to Egypt?
Yeah. Famine.
There's a famine, so?
Well,
does that justify going to Egypt?
There's food in Egypt.
There's food in Egypt,
right.
When
you have people following you as you did, you kind of think about how many feet on these.
All the 300 military guys?
Well, if you have 300 military guys, how many more people do you have? Because that's...
Yeah, that's a lot.
If they're just fighters, then you have to have other people.
He's got a large camp thinking about others. And he's a generous person.
He should have gone back from to where he came from. That was more familiar.
Yeah, that's interesting, huh? Maybe it was like a compromise. He knew he'd been called out from his homeland, but in a moment of weakness, he's like, I need something to go to. Maybe I'll try Egypt. At least it's not going back to my home that God called me out of. And if you compare all the sister stories, when he says, she's my sister, they're progressively better as he stays closer to the promised land. But that's the outcome is progressively better. But that's another whole Bible study in itself. But I would definitely say that was maybe a lack of faith on Abraham's part to run away to Egypt when times got tough. And there was a result, I think, if you follow Abraham and Sarah and their whole relationship. That's another very interesting trend, which we'll be looking at again this morning. Let's start by reading a couple of verses, actually just the first verse. Who wants to read it? Genesis 23:1.
Sarah lived to be 127 years old.
All right. Nice. Why do I stop us there? What's curious about this statement?
What was the age? 127.
127.
She's over the cap.
Yeah. She's over the cap. That's true. How old did Moses?
Mom and Dad had to build three times.
How old was Moses when he died?
120.
120. And if anyone is here in Israel today and you have a birthday, what do they say? Ad mea vesrim. Unto 120. That's considered the limit of mortal life. Yeah, so she's 7 past. The other interesting thing is she's the only woman in the Bible where her age is specified. Is that because it's not polite to mention a woman's age?
Yes.
Yes. No.
No.
I think the reason, it's a curious fact, and we can all offer our reasons why that is. I think the main reason is probably to give a firm date for the following selection of when this cave is being bought, because this is a big deal, as we're going to see. The buying of the Machpelah, in the fields of Ephron, the Hittite. But it is interesting about Sarah. And the other interesting thing, if you're reading in Hebrew, I'll just read it for you. Vayhi ahare advarim ha'ele, vayugad lav, vayu haye sara me'a shana ve'esrim shana ve'sheva shanim. Shnei haye sara. So it's split up. The years of Sarah's life were 100 years, and 20 years, and 7 years. The years of the life of Sarah. So, an interesting little verse, and a lot of interpretation has been attracted to this verse. Why do they split up the numbers? Does anyone know any of these interpretations?
I
will tell you.
I don't.
So, obviously, you know, if we're going to squeeze every word of the Torah for the juice it gives, if it's split up, that means there's more to squeeze, right? You squeeze 100 and the 20 and the 7. And people string them together. So they say, at 100 years, she was like 20 insofar as sin is concerned. She was as innocent as she was at 20. And at 20, she was like 7 as far as beauty. Interesting. I would think of 20-year-old more beautiful than 7, but okay. Maybe in terms of soft, new beauty. Yeah. And there were others. That was Rashi. There was other... What was the other one? I didn't write it down. But the same concept of... At 100, well, one I think was at 100 she was as strong as she was when she was 20. And at 20 she was something else as was she was when she was 7. So the same principle of interpreting each of the chunks
now,
to be special.
Whenever they say Mea Ve'asrim Ve'sheva, is that different than how they would normally do it today?
Oh, yeah.
Look. How would you normally say 120?
No, it says here, it says Mea Shana Ve'esrim Shana Ve'sheva Shani.
Yeah.
It would be saying she was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years.
That's not normal.
And some also have mentioned, it doesn't actually line up with her life story, but they mentioned how this signifies that there are different seasons of life. And so for Sarah, of course, the biggest season was her season of what do you call it? Barrenness. And then after that, how long was Sarah barren?
90
years. And then Isaac is born. And then I think we also touched last week on the binding of Isaac. In Christian interpretation, we've always seen like a little boy that Abraham's leading. Where in Jewish, it's between 25 and 37, depending how you do the math. But if you just take it for face value, if Sarah had him at 90, and then here she's dying at age 127, and this is immediately following the binding of Isaac, that would put Isaac at 37 years old. And Jewish interpretation emphasizes then how Isaac was part of this. It was his willingness. He willingly gave himself up. And so it's showing Isaac's character. There are other interpretations. People who read the stories in light of each other say, why is Sarah's death mentioned here, right after the binding of Isaac?
It freaked her out so much that she had a heart attack and died.
Exactly. It freaked her out so much she panicked and died. And there are two trends of that. One is that just the news that it almost happened was enough to freak her out. But the other interpretation is that it actually did happen. And he came back to life. And you think, whoa, whoa, whoa. Let's not, like, weave too much into the scripture. But there is an interesting little verse that led to this interpretation. Does anyone know it? Besides Hebrews, yeah, there is Hebrews. He said he believed even that he could raise them from the dead.
Rebecca, Nephal from the camel.
Oh, okay, but that's later. I'm thinking of one in chapter 22.
Is that when he says, we're going to worship and we'll come back?
Close, and then what happens?
It's when Abraham says he left and departed to Beersheba. It's in the same
with Ishmael, isn't it, right?
Well, if you look at verse 19, look at Genesis 22:19. What does it say there?
So Abraham returned unto his young men, and they rose up and went together to Beersheba.
Right.
And Abraham dwelt at Beersheba.
Okay. It says, so he returned. Singular. So Abraham returned. There's no mention of Isaac. And so this led to the interpretation that Isaac wasn't around. And I guess maybe he shows up to Sarah and looks a little ghost-like and scares her.
Well, did he tell her when he left what they were going to do? He probably didn't.
Probably not. I don't think it would have been wise.
No.
Seeing as he didn't even tell his servants, right? He told the servants, you sit here, we'll go on.
Yeah.
And that could have had its effect on Abraham and Sarah's relationship. And if we get to chapter 24, you're right that there is that interpretation of Rebecca falling off her camel because she sees Isaac coming to her, and the interpretation was that he's got a shining body because he's back from the dead, and or ghost-like or whatever, and so it scares her. Very interesting. A lot of these interpretations maybe aren't played up anymore because you could draw close parallels to Jesus, which was already, Christians through the centuries have already seen in this story a prefiguring of Jesus.
But also, these interpretations, they came around because of the Greek culture they were in, where they would have trouble killing their kids for the salvation of the city.
Where they would have, they would?
Yeah, like...
But even in Abraham's day, we had the kings, different, well, not Abraham's, but later on in the kingdom, kings sacrificing their son at a moment of great disaster to try to kind of twist the arm of the gods in their direction.
Right, and I forget this reference in Josephus, but it was... The city was under a plague, and they said, well, if we'll just kill the son outside the city, then the plague will leave. And so they had no problem. So the idea is maybe that the rabbis or the people at the time interacting with Greeks said, well, Abraham almost killed Isaac. That's a big deal. So-and-so just killed their kid.
Right, right. Yeah, some crazy ideas to us today. Okay, what talked a bit about the first verse. Moving straight on to the second verse. Someone reads verse 2 for us.
So,
chapter 22.
So Abraham said to the old servant of his house, who ruled over all
he had... chapter 23.
Oh, sorry. So Sarah died in Kiryat Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham came to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her.
All right, this is a great verse here.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay, where's Kiryat Arba?
Hebron.
Good.
Okay,
she's good.
That's great. Where's Hebron?
Today it's in the West Bank, right?
It's in the West Bank, yes.
It's in Judea.
Yes. And it's in the land. What people were in Hebron in the time of Abraham?
Apparently the Hittites.
Apparently the Hittites. The Hittites. And they were, we're going to look at several of those places that we mentioned, Hittim, in a little bit. It's the hill country. The Hittim are one of the peoples mentioned in the hill country, in the land of Canaan, or Canaan.
So did they, you know, did they get separated? Were they having American problems? What's going on here?
That's exactly the question. Have people put two and two together?
He was in Beersheba.
In verse 19 that we just read, it says, they all went together to Beersheba. Vayeshev Avraham b'Beersheba. And Abraham dwelled in Beersheba. So what's Sarah doing in Hebron?
Morning.
There have been many interpretations, right?
Maybe she
left Abraham took her son away to go and sacrifice him.
Maybe. And we're forced to interpret because there are no details of their personal life. But there are the facts. Here she is in Hebron, and here he is in Beersheba. And the word used of Abraham in Beersheba is one, he is dwelling there.
Right.
It's not one he's visiting.
Yes, that's,
you can't, if you read that in, you're trying too hard. I mean, you're twisting the words.
But in that culture, that was very unusual for a woman to be alone.
Maybe. Who says she's alone? I mean, maybe she has her own repertoire of servants. And again, Abraham and Sarah are pretty well off.
Yeah, true.
And I'm sure that Abraham would have made sure she was cared for.
Wouldn't it be odd for them to be in quite distinct locations?
It would be odd. Especially seeing as, you know, they're both immigrants. They're coming from a different country, and to split up and to actually move away from each other.
But in verse 3, Abraham rose from beside his dead, so he was there when she died.
Well, does it say that?
No, in Hebrew.
It says, Sarah died in Hebron, the land of Canaan, and Abraham came to mourn her.
Okay.
Now, there's something subtle. If you have this nice English Standard Version,
mm-hmm.
Do you want to hear what they say?
Wait, on that last verse that you just read, is that verse 3?
That
verse
was two. Verse 2.
Genesis
23, verse 2. And Sarah died at Kiryat Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Very nice. They've added an in. Went in. A very subtle little addition. But then what does it say in our minds? Well, he went into her tent.
There's no fate.
Red diagram.
Maybe they put their interpretation into this translation.
Oh, for sure. For sure. It doesn't... There is no going in. It just says Abraham came to mourn her.
Yeah, but maybe they had a reason to assume that he was already dwelling near her in the same city, or because otherwise I don't understand why they would make that little change. So probably they had some reason to think when they translated that.
Well, how about the reason that they don't want to view them as being separated?
Yeah, maybe it's that, I don't know.
But it would
it's not a bad reason.
It would be strange to say Vayavo and he came and Abraham came to mourn over Sarah and to cry for her.
Mm-hmm.
It would be strange to say come at all. It would be more like you just say
Sabur.
Vayisbud. Right?
Yeah, if he's already there, you would just say he mourned her. You could say Vayakom Lisbod, he got up to mourn her. Because that's often before any action you get up to do it with the intention of doing it. It's very curious. And if you're just piecing the data together, the most basic interpretation is that they're living in two different places. And then you can start trying to understand why that would have happened. And someone already suggested, well, maybe they had marriage issues. Even in really late in life, it can happen, especially when it concerns children and the direction your children are going.
and killing them.
And killing your children. That may have somewhat of an effect on people. We are talking about humans. And remember, when God gave the command to Abraham, he didn't tell Sarah. And God did not. We do not have a record in the Bible that God told Sarah. So as far as from Sarah's perspective, Abraham could just be crazy.
Or if we add in Claire Fawn's interpretation, I can't remember a couple years ago when she talked about it, how she traced through the relationship of Abraham and Sarah and showed how
it was already rocky.
He had taken the prompt in chapter 12, Lech Lecha Me'atzot Lecha, he took the promise for himself, and he was willing to let her go in Egypt, the very beginning, chapter 12, because he wanted to make sure that he didn't die because the promise was supposed to be fulfilled through him.
Right.
He didn't see it as a promise to the both of them, and she felt the resentment over and over.
Right, like, are you willing to give me up?
Are you willing to give me up? Is this just something that God is doing through you? It's possible, I'm totally, you know, bringing it there, it's possible that she, once again, felt miffed by him. When he heard this thing from God of what to do with Abraham, that she was not included, and I'm real hard to understand what's going on, but that could be a reason why she's like, that's the last straw.
And you have sometimes God tell him, I'm going to preserve your line through Sarah.
Definitely.
Exactly.
Definitely.
God, the fact that God has to remind Abraham implies that Abraham wasn't remembering that.
He was thinking it could happen.
And he was thinking, I'll just make it happen through me.
And
you know, Hagar.
And even when God says, you know, it's going to happen through Sarah, I can't remember exactly what he says, but
why wouldn't
your worship be on Ishmael? Right.
Right. Kind of like, I don't really need her.
Yeah.
And Abraham keeps saying, no, actually, you do, and I'm going to bless Sarah's line.
Right.
Which is kind of nice. That, you know, God views them as one. And he wants to bring the promise through their unity, which he does do, even if there was disunity within that unity.
What does that say about, like, pastors or those types of roles? Like, how much of a team?
This is interesting because you have a real person. And you can look at him from a distance and just see him as the father of faith, which he is. And it's a wonderful example. And then you can look up close and see where maybe he had some failings. And that's maybe where we shouldn't follow Abraham's footsteps. Like, you see this subtle, maybe it's a subtle critique that God keeps reminding, the ideal is I want to bless you together. And so, as if we were to apply it to our lives today, I think we'd be looking at the ideal that's between the lines, that's found in the critique, as opposed to what Abraham actually did. And I know a lot of people, you know, we like to say, well, that's biblical. And, well, so much is biblical. You know, how do you find a wife? You go, you know, there's all kinds of answers to that that are biblical, you know. And so it's not fair to just say, because it appears in the Bible, this is something we should emulate. We have to measure it and read it in context and reread it and see the nuances.
Yeah, Abraham may have passed 10 tests, but he definitely failed the test. Here's my hand. That's enough.
Yeah.
That messed up.
Or it just shows that, like, when you have a calling and you're married, you got to make sure that it fits your spouse practically.
Right.
You can't just say, oh, this looks good, but if the circumstances aren't working out for your spouse as well,
then you just pull your way through.
Yeah, you can't just like, well, look, it's working out for me right now. Make it work for yourself, spouse.
Right. God has called me to whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, be happy. Find happiness in this barren place.
You sin.
Yeah.
Right.
And yet, the beautiful picture of grace is that God did work through Abraham.
Right.
And I think he did fail on that. He didn't quite get that part. And yet God was able to work through him, and work through Sarah, and work through Abraham's mistakes, you know, through trying to do things his own way. And maybe that's why chapter 23, that's another reason why chapter 23 is so significant. Because here he is, let's assume for the present that they are separated.
Okay.
Sarah's living in Hebron and Abraham's in Beersheba. He comes to mourn her. He didn't even make it there. He heard, if you notice at verse 20 before, he's heard news from his homeland way back in, you know, Ur Kasdim about Milcah and all their children. And yet, surely he could have heard news from Hebron. Surely he could have heard, you know, Sarah has been sick or something like that. But
she didn't say she died from sickness.
No, it doesn't. And again, we could attribute it to the shock factor, the heart attack.
Oh, it could be. It could be that she's 127 years old.
It could be.
Yeah.
But he wasn't there when she actually died.
Right.
So there was no closure in that sense. But he did go to mourn for her. So how much that's even greater a value if you're assuming that the relationship wasn't ideal, wasn't reconciled, yet he goes to mourn her.
Right.
And this is a big thing. Maybe today we're less, if you're coming from a Western country, burial is less of a value to us. It's somewhat of a value. We go, we have, we can get cheaper plane tickets to go to a funeral. But in Judaism, it's a huge value. And it's one of the acts of loving kindness, milut hasadim.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it's in the same category as feeding the poor, visiting people in prisons, burying the dead. And why is it so esteemed?
Because they can't pay you back.
They cannot pay you back. So therefore, it's the ultimate test of your character. And here, once again, we're back to this ultimate test of Abraham's character. He's showing up to mourn Sarah and to cry for her.
So it's seen as an act of loving kindness to that dead person, not like, I mean, in our Western sort of culture, we chalk it up to the
survivors.
Yeah, exactly. It's a healing experience because of, for the people who are grieving, for the families that are there. You go to comfort the people who are there. It's a healing process for yourself. It's good and warm.
Right. No, it's actually seen as an act of loving kindness to the person who died, to show respect by burying them.
Because there's like five things where the ultimate acts of righteousness, and then the top one is visiting the dead, because you're giving that person a good name because they're not going to carry on with themselves, is a good name, so they show that they were loved.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So I have a few examples we could read. This would be in people's thoughts around Jesus' day. It's recorded later in the Talmud, Tractate Sukkah 49b. They expand the verse in Micah 6:8, which we all know. He has told you, O man, what is good and what does the Lord require of you?
Yeah.
To do justice, to love hesed, to love this steadfast, you could say, loving kindness. And so they expand. What is this loving kindness? Okay, to do justice means to act with justice. To love mercy refers to acts of loving kindness, gmilut hasadim. And to walk humbly with your God refers to attending to funerals and dowering a bride for her wedding. So, one
so
interpretation.
That's the Babylonian one.
Walking humbly. That's Babylonian Sukkah 49b. And again, also, when you're going into a dead person, you're making yourself unclean.
Mm-hmm.
You're reduced, so in that way, it is a humbling act. You're reducing yourself to a lowly state. Like, you know, when Jesus washed the feet of the disciples, he's reducing himself to a lowly state for their benefit, to honor them. And he gave that as an example to us as well. Then there's other passages that speak of honoring one's parents with the same thought of deeds of loving kindness. Where was the other one? So
I think one of them is giving without, like giving to a third party, like giving without being known.
Giving without being known, correct. That would certainly be in Jesus' list of things to emulate. If we remember back in, let's just flip back to Genesis 18.
Okay.
19?
Yeah. One of the reasons we're given of why Abraham is chosen mm-hmm. is here. Mm-hmm. Because I have known him. Lema'an asher yetzaved banav. Because he will command his children, ved beto, and his household after him. And they will keep the way of the Lord to do tzedakah, which is... it can be justice, it can be acts of mercy to people, it can be giving to charity. That's how it was interpreted in Jesus' day, giving to charity. Umishpat, this is justice. So that God would bring on him everything he said. So Abram's been chosen because of his love of justice and acts of kindness to people, which we have noticed throughout his life and we're going to still notice. And so one of these in Exodus 18:20, the way of the Lord would include these deeds of loving kindness, like visiting the sick and burying the dead. Also in the Jerusalem Talmud, Pe'ah 1:1, it talks about burying an old man is a deed of loving kindness.
I like how Bob Lindsay also said, just where you see justice and righteousness throughout the prophets, it's just salvation. Salvation of God.
Yeah, it's a salvation of God breaking through when you're doing these things that God is doing. Because God identifies with the poor and the orphan and the people, I guess you could say in this case, the people can't take care of themselves, which ultimately a dead person obviously can't. And also we have the image of God bearing Moses. So that was also an act of loving kindness towards Moses. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is a big value, and it's showing Abraham's ultimate respect for Sarah after everything. He comes and he mourns for her. Okay, so we don't have much time. I warned you we won't get much past chapter 23. I did anticipate getting more than two verses. So let's read a bit. Verse 3 and following.
Keep lingering on interesting matters, Sharon.
That's right. Who can read for us in a nice, clear, crisp way?
Verse 3. And Abraham rose from before his dead and spoke to the sons of Heth, saying,
keep reading.
I am a stranger and a sojourner among you. Give me a burial site among you that I may bury my dead out of my sight.
Okay, I'll just make two comments. He's saying meti all the time. What strikes you about that? Met.
Dead.
Right? What else? Hebrew 101, guys. Met. Who died?
Well,
Sarah. It's a meta.
Sarah meta. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right? So he's using masculine. He's saying my dead. And maybe we could see in that, obviously, he has a practical situation right there and then. The first significant person in his household has died. But maybe he's saying, my dead in general. Right? I need a place to bury my dead. So it's not just Sarah, it's all my dead. Mm-hmm. And that, therefore, is using masculine. Okay, keep reading. Verse 4.
Verse 5?
Verse 5, yes.
The sons of Heth answered Abraham, saying to him, hear us, my lord, you are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead.
Excellent. So he's got a first response. He makes a request and gets a response. And they say, listen. If you ever listen just out on the streets today, it's kind of fun when you read this story because you hear the same kind of shema, you know, tishma, listen up. And then you state your thing. What is their answer, essentially?
We'll give you one.
Do they really say, we'll give it to you?
Choose one.
No, we won't refuse it to him.
We won't refuse if you bury your dead in our graves. Mm-hmm. Okay? So they're saying, yeah, you are a foreigner and an alien, so don't worry about it. You know, gratis. You just bury your dead people in one of our caves. And
it's not just that you're a foreigner, you're a Nesi Elohim.
Right.
You're like the Prince of God.
You're Prince of God. So we respect you. You can have your access to any one of these graves.
Because he characterizes himself as Gevurah Toshav,
right.
And they say, you're not just a Gevurah Toshav, you're a Nesi Elohim.
Exactly. So he has presented himself more humbly than the truth. And then they present him as probably above the truth.
Right.
But the bottom line is, you can use our graves. But what was Abraham's request?
Buy.
I want one as an ahuzat kever. An ahuzat is a land possession.
Mm-hmm. You know, mighty prince and the seat of him.
That's what?
My translation just says mighty prince and the seat of him. It is
different.
It is. Well, it has a prince of God, which there are several cases in the Bible where Elohim is used as just very, very big, apparently. Right. So you think of Nineveh. It's a city unto God, like big unto God, meaning huge. So it could be used in that sense,
mm-hmm.
or you could take it more literally as they recognize something about Abraham's connection to God, that he was honored by God. Of course, in an ancient worldview, anyone really rich, you tend to think, oh, they have the blessing, you
right.
know. So it's kind of a logical connection.
Prince of God preaches much better than just mighty prince.
That's right. And the blessing of Abraham really preaches.
It does.
I've heard a lot of people talk about the blessing of Abraham. And in Abraham's generous spirit, that everyone would be blessed. That's great. Anyway, so they're subtly saying, no, you can't have your own grave, but you're welcome to borrow. Okay, so verse 7. Keep reading.
So Abraham rose and bowed to the people of the land, the sons of Heth. And he spoke with them, saying, if it is your wish for me to bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and approach Ephron, the son of Zoar, for me, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns, which is at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence for a burial site.
Okay. So Abraham's hanging on to this for a burial site. He starts negotiating, basically. He starts where they left off. Okay, so I do have access to your graves? Great. Will you speak to so-and-so? I like his grave. I would like to buy it for the full price as a possession for a grave. He wants a land possession for a grave. Okay. So now it's giving us an aside in verse 10. By the way, Ephron lived with the sons of Het. And so now Ephron answers. Notice, Ephron Achiti. It keeps emphasizing Chiti. If you count throughout this selection, I think you'll find it, 8 or 9 times between the sons of Het and being a Chiti, which is interesting for interpretation. But we'll keep reading.
Now Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth, even of all who went in at the gate of his city, saying, no, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead.
All right. So this is a typical negotiation in a city gate. You go, you have witnesses. We think of the book of Ruth, the same thing's going on. Any transaction, land deed. So they're in the middle of a negotiation now. And he's saying, hey, look, no, don't worry about it. I give it to you. And everybody's a witness that I'm giving it to you. And we're going to get Abraham's response. Verse 12.
And Abraham bowed before the people of the land. He spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, saying, if you will only please listen to me, I will give you the price of the field. Accept it from me that I may bury my dead there.
All right, so Abraham is insisting. And notice this is the second time he's bowed down. Not just to Ephron, who he's doing business with. It says to Am Haaretz, to the average person. So again, we see kind of a generosity when it comes to social standing. which is humility. Abraham's very humble here. He's making himself humble.
That's all I can make a political comment here, but I won't.
Well, you can.
No.
It's begging us to make the political comment, but not to apply it to any specific policy, rather to apply it to a particular attitude, the attitude of humility, and insisting on buying the land when it was offered to him for free. Wow. Okay. So, verse 14.
Then Ephron answered Abraham, saying to him, "My lord, listen to me. I priced a piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver. What is that between me and you? So bury your dead." And Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, commercial standard.
There you go.
Commercial standard.
Yeah, no, he specifies it. Over la soher. This is awesome. Again, you know, just go to the old city. Hey, you know, 400 shekels, what's that between us, you know? It's a very roundabout way of giving the price without really giving the price because you've just offered it for free. Hey, but don't worry about it. It's free. And so Abraham reads between the lines and says, okay, you're asking 400 shekels. I'm not even going to bargain. I'm just going to give it to you. And he weighs it out. What do you guys think about that price, 400 shekels?
Must be a lot.
Yeah. I would say it's overpriced. How much overpriced? You can try to, you know, do the back calculations, which I didn't do, but seriously overpriced. And yet, Abraham doesn't, he takes the exorbitant price. He doesn't even want to negotiate. He buys it for an exorbitant price. So, verse 17.
So Ephron's field, which was in Machpelah, which faced Mamre, the field and cave which was in it, and all the trees which were in the field that were within all the confines of its border were deeded over to Abraham for a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth before all who went in at the gate of his city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field at Machpelah, Besi Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded over to Abraham for a burial site by the sons of Heth.
Okay, so we finally got, the last verse says, so it became established as a achuzat kever, as a possession for a burial. So this is the first piece of land that Abraham owns in this country. And how did he get it? He bought it for an exorbitant price after bowing to the people of the land many times in big humility. And it's very important that we know he bought it, because elsewhere in the text we have mentioned Asher Kana Avraham, which Abraham bought. Which Abraham bought. If you want a few, there's Genesis 25:10, there's Genesis 49:30, Genesis 50:13. Those are the ones I wrote down. There could be one elsewhere in our Bible. But this emphasized that Abraham didn't just walk in and take something. He bought it fair and square. And not only fair and square, but for more than it was worth, with genuine financial transaction, all the required witnesses, the whole deal. And back to the beginning of this Bible study, we mentioned how this was his final test. And one of the things brought up was patience. He tested his patience. Because if you notice, not once does he mention the promise to him of this land. So he believes, he has faith in that promise, and yet here he is buying the smallest little corner and not even mentioning, hey, by the way, you guys, all this land is mine. Could you just get out of here? You know, and that is amazing. I think that character trait speaks in Abraham's day and in Jesus' day and in our day as strongly when we start thinking about it. We even have a little more time. Mm-hmm. And again, this is a precedent.
Chapter Jacob doesn't do so well on this issue.
Not as well, but he comes around the end, he wants to be buried in the cave, the same cave.
I mean, the first bit of land that they get in a different kind of way.
Right. And it would be interesting to see all the different characters and how they go about getting their land. I was reminded recently, okay, I'll just bring in politics. I'm from America, and so we've just had elections, and I was thinking about the verse in Joshua where the commander of God's army comes to him, apparently an angelic army. Joshua says, "Are you a Republican or a Democrat?" And he says, "Neither. I am the Lord's, as a commander of the Lord's army, I now come." And how God is above it all. And even the promise he gave Joshua is going to be God's way or no way. Like, you can't decide how it's going to happen. You have to always be listening to God, how God is going to make it happen. And that's, I mean, it's right there in our text. Even in the book of Joshua, which people outside of our faith always point to as, well, look at Joshua, you know, you have all this pillage and, or like complete destruction. But in each incident, there was never a blanket statement of, all right, guys, just go in and kill them all every time. Each instance, they had to check with God, okay, what are your plans for this city? How do we do it? What's going to happen? I did promise that we were going to go through all the different nations, but I don't think we'll get to that. It just interested me reading through chapter 23 how often the Hittites were mentioned. And it's also interesting that Esau's wives are Hittites. And it's a bother to Isaac. And here though, we have Abraham honoring and bowing down to the Hittites repeatedly as representative of the Canaanite people. So unless anyone has another statement to say about this section of Parasha. I'm sorry we didn't get to the huge love story of Rebecca, but it's a long one. I'll leave that for you guys to read. It did inspire me. I have this nose ring here because of that story.
Oh, really?
That's right. Uh-huh. Well, I kind of like nose rings anyway. I said, see you, Rebecca has one.
I did that too with my grandma when I got an earring. I was like, but servants used to get their ears pierced.
That's
they
right.
Wanted to stay. I don't want to stay with the Lord. So.
That's right. Actually, Gary did give me a nose ring when he proposed.
Okay.
Not this one, a different one. But with that, don't follow Abraham's example of his relationship, but do follow his example of his extreme humility and his faithfulness. Even above his whatever relationship feelings he had, he was faithful to Sarah ultimately in showing her respect of burial and showing other people respect who may not have deserved it, the Hittites all around him, and paying exorbitant prices. So go and do likewise.
Good job.